listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a nurse who's also an artist takes us inside the world of graphic medicine and explains why comics might be the key to better health.
Now, genealogy has been popular for hundreds, even thousands of years.
And much more recently, millions of people have sent in DNA samples to learn more about their genetic background and who's in their family.
William Irvine is a professor of philosophy at Wright State University in Dayton, Ohio. He's always been fascinated by science and set out to look at how each of us came into existence, which he explains in his book, You, A Natural History. Bill, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here. Thank you for asking.
So your book is titled You, A Natural History. Which scientific disciplines did you examine to pull together this story?
A whole bunch. I drew from many different areas. I drew from biology. I drew from astronomy. I drew from geology. The idea was to give as complete an idea of your history as I could. And, of course, we think of you as a person. But that's only one of the ways we can see you. You're also, for instance, a member of a species. You're a collection of cells. You're a collection of atoms. And so to give the complete picture of you, it requires a lot of science.
I think it's really interesting that you named it you, not us or humankind. Why really speak to the potential reader in that way?
When I wrote the book, I mean, it really was a very person-centric kind of approach. And I wondered, well, where did I come from? How did I come to be here? What was the process that happened? And so, you know, ideally that when readers read this book, they're going to be doing the same, except they're going to be doing it with respect to themselves. So, as I've said, they have a long and very interested and convoluted history because they aren't one entity. There are multiple entities that happen to be fused together. So I'm hoping they take it personally.
In the best possible way. And I find this fascinating. You are a philosopher. You are not someone who is in one of these scientific traditions that you rely on for this book. How did you as a philosopher come to write it?
I think I'm a philosopher in the ancient sense of the word. You know, if you go back to the ancient Greek and Roman philosophers, for instance, they had an interest in philosophy, but they also were polymaths in the sense that they were also interested in science, for instance. They were interested in math. They were interested in logic. And so this book, I've had a lifelong interest in science, decided that I would end up doing philosophy instead, but have had this burning background interest. And, you know, philosophy raises these meaning of life sort of questions. And you can look to science for the answers. And so I was kind of working that seam between science and philosophy. So how did I get here? And, you know, the idea is maybe if you knew that, you'd have some idea of why you're here and what exactly this is all about. So that's how kind of philosophy and science unite.
There are so many fascinating concepts and ideas in your book, and unfortunately, we'll only have time to look at a few. Now, I am not trained in science, and until a recent interview we did with David Quammen about his book, The Tangled Tree, I had a very simplistic and, it turns out, inaccurate view of how species develop. And you say that not only are all human beings related, but any two living organisms have an ancestor in common if you go back far enough. How is that possible?
Well, the evidence that has to be the case is we all use DNA, and the DNA uses the same code for decoding our DNA and turning it into stuff, into the things we know. The only way things could share that same code is if they all had inherited that code from some distant ancestor. So it's smoking gun evidence that we do have an ancestor in common. And then after that, it becomes this interesting question of how far back do you have to go to find that ancestor? And you have to go pretty far back. I mean, it would be a single-celled organism of some kind. And so you're going back billions of years. You know, but each of your cells, you know, I told you, you can think of yourself as a cellular creature, as a collection of cells. Each of those cells can trace its origin back to some cell billions of years ago. That cell has been alive and reproducing ever since, and we're just the collection of the current manifestation of that cell. But it's interesting. You know, I mean, the other interesting thing is any two people are also related. It's just a question of how far back you have to go to find a common ancestor.
We're talking with William Irvine. He's professor of philosophy at Wright State University in Dayton, Ohio. And we're talking about his most recent book, which is titled You, A Natural History. So we're talking about something that's referred to as the last universal common ancestor, and that is where every living organism came from. How are scientists able to trace that?
Okay, one thing you can do is you can look for similarities. I mean, so we are, if you look at animals, we're most similar to chimpanzees. So the assumption is that we had a common ancestor with them. And what has helped that process along is the DNA research that's been done. And now we can go around and look at the DNA of all these different species and then look for resemblances in the DNA. So we share a large amount of our DNA with chimpanzees, you know, and the way that would happen is if we had an ancestor in common. The ancestor, by the way, it wouldn't have been either a member of the species Homo sapiens, nor would it have been a chimpanzee. It would have been some other kind of organism, presumably, that evolved into itself, that evolved into humans and into chimpanzees. But we have, you know, it's estimated 98% of our DNA in common with chimpanzees, and the only way that could happen is if we had a fairly recent ancestor in common. Much the same way, think about you and your siblings, if you have any. There's going to be a strong family resemblance, and if you did your DNA test, you'd find a remarkable degree of similarity between the DNA that you had. So a species, it kind of works the same way.
So the last universal common ancestor is what all organisms have in common. And then those of us who are in that Homo sapien category, we have most recent common ancestors with, for instance, chimpanzees. So that's kind of a subset of the last universal common ancestor.
Right. And then you could go back. You could pick, if you could do the deep history of every single living organism, you would finally go back to about 4 billion years ago. It would have been a cellular organism and or a cellular species of organism that, if something had happened to it, God forbid, none of the current species would be here now. There'd be maybe other different species here, but not the ones we know and love.
So that's really interesting, because in reading that, it felt almost like a sci-fi novel plot line. What happened if the ancestor that we all have didn't exist? Either something happened before it could reproduce, or reproduction wasn't successful. So you said there might have been then other species. So is it kind of like a story where there are these alternate possible universes? So Earth could look completely different if one of those organisms wasn't successful.
Sure. That's another thing that comes out of the research for this book, just how remarkably contingent our planet and the living things on our planet are. For instance, it's estimated that several hundred million years after our planet came into existence, it was hit by another planet. If that hadn't happened, we wouldn't have a moon. If we didn't have a moon, we wouldn't have the tides. If we didn't have the tides, that would have affected how life evolved. So it's a strange kind of thing. What looks like a disaster early in our history was actually an event that helped everything that happened after that. And the same is true. You know, you have all of these little accidents happening that got us to where we are now. And, of course, you wouldn't be here if your father hadn't met your mother, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they hadn't gotten together. You wouldn't be here. And it could have been an accident of two people, same place, same time. So we live in a highly contingent universe. And that can make you really nervous, but that should also make you just think, isn't this a wonderful place that through all that process, we have what we have today.
Well, and Bill, that actually brings me to the last question I wanted to ask you, which is how amazing and unlikely is it that any one of us is actually here on Earth today?
Yep, it's a long shot. And then, you know, you think, does that make us incredibly special? Well, we are special, but there's a good chance that because the universe is such an absolutely huge place, that we aren't the only place it's happened. I mean, you know, you go into a casino and you ask, what's the chance of, you know, the number 17 coming up on roulette 5 times in a row? Well, gee, that would be almost impossible. But if you have billions and billions and billions of casinos, on one of those each night, that's going to happen. And that's kind of the math of our universe.
Well, Bill, thank you so much for sharing your really fascinating book and explaining how we got here.
It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Bill Irvine is professor of philosophy at Wright State University in Dayton, Ohio. He's a best-selling author and joined us to talk about his most recent book titled You, A Natural History.
Coming up, we'll hear from a nurse who says comics can actually improve the way we talk about health. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, if your idea of a town in the 1800s includes some rowdy drinkers at the local saloon, gambling, and even some gunfights in the street, a visit to one Wisconsin town in around 1850 might match that image. Fair Play, now a ghost town, was a frontier town located in Grant County. A historian tells us more about Wisconsin ghost towns, where and how she tracks them down.
Now, when it comes to talking about our health, including illness, disability, or even the prospect of death, things aren't always easy, even for those who make a living in the medical field. But what if there was a better way?
Our next guest has turned to comics to improve communication about health. She says comics have the power to make health education more engaging and can amplify the voices of patients and families, as well as giving us a good way to explore our experiences with health and medicine.
M.K. Serwick is known as Comic Nurse. In addition to being a nurse, she's an artist in residence at the Northwestern Feinberg School of Medicine and is one of the founders of the field of graphic medicine. M.K., thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, what got you into tackling this question of can I use comics and graphic novels to improve people's health?
Well, it started very personally in that I was working as a nurse on an AIDS unit during the mid-90s before we had new medications to keep the virus under control. And I was really struggling to bridge the world on our unit, which was really just a difficult place, and everything seemed like the worst news and the outcome was always bad. And life off the unit, which was much more balanced, and it just was, I was having trouble bridging that. And so one day I just sat down and drew a little picture and put a few words, put a box around it, made another box, and I stumbled into making comics. And 9 panels later, I found myself in a place of hope and perspective, and I felt ready to go on and take on the next day's challenges at work.
Had you been an artist before that?
No, not at all. I was
really?
I was one of those kids at school that the teacher said, put those crayons away. Please stop drawing. You can use your words now.
And so when did you start showing your work sharing it with other people?
I think I felt like, so my first degree before I went into nursing was in literature and philosophy, and I'd always wanted a place in the arts, but I never felt like I could find a home. And after I'd made a few comics and realized how powerful this medium was, I felt like I was actually kind of good at it, and that I wanted to share them, and that I felt like it had a lot of potential.
We hear a lot about communication in healthcare between physicians and nurses, for example, healthcare providers and patients and families, so on. And that's a problem a lot of the time. Are you helping to bridge the gap with the comics?
I really hope so and think so. One of the really interesting conventions that comics bring that I've found in my teaching is the power of the speech bubble and the thought bubble. So if you think about, if you're drawing a comic, no matter who you are, whether you're a provider or a patient or a family member, and you're drawing a clinical encounter, you have the opportunity to show what the person is saying and what they're thinking, which really shows what they're worried about, what they're not saying, right? And that's, you know, for the, like I said, for the physicians or the nurses, just as well as the patients.
It reminds me of a comic I saw on your website, a daughter and a father out for dinner, and they hear bad news about somebody they know, and they're both thinking about talking about end-of-life care, and they're only doing it through most of it in thought bubble form. Talk about how you set that up and how you frame that for people.
Well, what the goal of that comic was to really just sort of demonstrate that it's a really hard conversation, right, to have, to acknowledge that the person that you love most in the world is going to die and talk about what their hopes and dreams are for what that's going to be like, right? We don't like to talk about that. Mm-hmm. And so I made that comic as a way to sort of model another way of approaching it. And that's part of a larger project, hoping that comics can have a role in approaching those conversations.
We're talking to M.K. Serwick, also known as the comic nurse. She's a nurse and she's also a comic artist. And she says there's a lot of room in comics to help our healthcare communication, maybe ultimately our health. So, M.K., how do you bring this to healthcare providers?
By things like traveling around talking about it, but also through teaching. I teach a course at Northwestern Medical School with first and second year medical students, and I get them to draw about the process of becoming a doctor and the relationships they're learning how to have with their patients.
Is there ever pushback? Like, hey, wait a minute, I'm here to learn anatomy and patient care and things like that, and you want me to draw?
You know, you'd be surprised how much there isn't. Well, first of all, they get to...
It's got to be a nice break, right?
Exactly. I mean, and I start with crayons, and so, like, who doesn't love picking up a box of 24 brand-new Crayola crayons? Quite honestly, they are facing learning so much that they're actually, I think, in a lot of ways, grateful for the opportunity to really start to process it.
You wrote a comic about a pivotal moment in your career, actually. It was your master's thesis, I think, and you're trying to decide, do I do the comic art? Are people going to take me seriously? Am I going to get away with that? Or should I do something a little more traditional? Talk about that key moment.
It was right when I had discovered a book called Mom's Cancer by Brian Feese, and I was finishing a master's in medical humanities and bioethics. And all of a sudden, I was sort of keeping it quiet that I was a cartoonist. I wanted to forefront the comics because this book was so good, and it really gave me hope that comics could have a serious place in the discourse of health and medicine. And yet, I was still nervous about it. I wanted to be taken seriously. And so I just put it to my professor and said, you choose. And what she said was, the other option was oral history. Sure, you could do your master's on oral history and its role in medicine, but we know what the answer is. With comics, maybe the answer is no. Maybe this is a crazy idea. Better to find out now.
You might fail.
Yeah, you might fail. And isn't that a more interesting question when you don't already know the answer?
How do you take this to, or do you take this to patients? Do you bring your work to patients as a nurse yourself?
Not right now myself as a nurse, but I know there's a lot of projects going on around the country and actually around the world. This has kind of become an international movement that we call graphic medicine. And there's research being done about the best way to, you know, medicine is evidence-based, so we want to make sure that we're doing the best practices and establishing those best practices. So there's research about what books are good with what patient population, when in their disease, when with their families. So these things are kind of being studied and looked at all over.
Is the idea that maybe someday, instead of, you know, a pamphlet, how to talk to your family about end-of-life care, or here's some information about dealing with, say, this particular type of cancer, it can be a little dense for some people, maybe more than others. Maybe a graphic alternative might be a better one.
Absolutely. And there are quite a few projects that are under research now. Comics are a really incredibly good educational resource when there's a lot of information. It's really important that the person learn the information and they're under a lot of stress. Comics are terrific in a place like that. So think about getting a diagnosis or even being in medical school or nursing school. Those are situations where, yeah, it helps a lot to have a easily accessible medium.
You mentioned one of the graphic novels that was your inspiration. Are there a lot of health-centered graphic novels and comics out there, either by patients or, in that case, a family member or other healthcare providers?
There are hundreds and more being made every
day.
Yes, and they're nonfiction, almost all exclusively nonfiction, and that means they're created by the people who are living through illness and caregiving. And who better to represent that experience? Not the caregivers, but the people who are living through it. They can teach us, and that's why it's great for these books to be read in health education schools.
You mentioned teaching doctors to do this. I assume the idea isn't that each of these doctors is going to go out and create their own healthcare graphic novel, but is there something therapeutic or educational for them to take what they're learning and put it on the page?
It's a terrific way to process information, and that's how we learn. We actually have to have a physical interaction with it, and so this is a terrific structure for doing that.
Could the same thing be done for patients? Again, they're not producing something for anybody else to see.
Right, absolutely. And many people have made the books they've made or even kept journals and said it was really a helpful way to go through things.
Have you heard from patients yourself that you've worked with who have, once you let it out there that you were a comic nurse. Did they take that inspiration and do something with it?
Absolutely. I remember I gave one lecture where a nurse in the back of the room, of course, you know, we're all patients and providers. A nurse in the back of the room said, I was just diagnosed with cancer and my family's really worried about me. And I'm going to make them a comic to tell them that I'm okay.
In your work, sometimes they're funny. Sometimes they're very emotionally painful almost, and that's true, I guess, across the comics world. Can you talk about capturing that range of experience?
Yeah, you know, comics do have an association with being funny, but that's certainly absolutely not the case exclusively. They have the gift of humor to bring, but often, you know, the tools of comics that the comics come with, being able to do so much in facial expressions with just a simple line, allows us to convey that emotion in ways that it would take 1,000 words to sometimes capture that complexity.
Healthcare is a demanding profession, emotionally draining, we hear a lot, and you were working, as you said, in the 90s with HIV-positive patients. Has this been therapeutic for you along the way?
It's definitely been helpful. One of the reasons I created my book, Taking Turns, which is a graphic memoir about that time, was to kind of take a look at that and process that and find a way to kind of be able to walk away from it.
What's it like sharing what was in your thought bubbles in real life, and all of a sudden they're on paper for everybody to see?
Yeah, it's a vulnerable process, but I think it's not unlike any creative endeavor where you really are going to be honest.
So what do you want people, healthcare providers that you're talking to in Madison to know about graphic medicine?
That the books that are out there that I'm going to talk about many different diseases and conditions are really, really useful tools. I would recommend going to graphicmedicine.org, our website, and it has a search panel, and you can kind of see if there's anything out there about any clinical interest area you might have.
MK, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you very much.
MK Surwick is known as Comic Nurse. In addition to being a nurse, she's an artist in residence at the Northwestern Feinberg School of Medicine and one of the founders of the field of graphic medicine.
Coming up after the news, wouldn't you like to have a taste of the world's biggest ice cream cones? Well, unfortunately, you'd have to time travel back to the early 1900s to visit the village of Strong's Prairie, now one of Wisconsin's many ghost towns. We hear from the historian and author of Wisconsin's Lost Towns. I'm Judith Sears-Boisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. The Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Boisson. Coming up, we'll learn about a Mexican community celebration that's an important Christmas tradition.
Now it seems hard to imagine a once thriving town in a place that now has no traces of life. But Wisconsin is home to many lost towns that were once homes to saloons, opera houses, post offices, schools, sawmills, hotels, and more.
In various states of decay, these abandoned towns can be found spread out in counties all over the state. Whether they thrived for a decade or over 100 years, they were home to the people who came before us.
Rhonda Fox is a regional historian living in Minnesota. She's the author of a series of books called Minnesota's Lost Towns and a Wisconsin edition, too, called Wisconsin's Lost Towns. Rhonda, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, how did you get curious about these ghost towns, these lost communities in the Midwest?
It's pretty easy. Actually, I've been doing it since I was as long as I can remember. My aunt in northern Wisconsin in Iron County up by Park Falls and Hurley, that area, she once owned property on which an old logging town once sat. And it was called Emerson, Wisconsin. And it was a quite substantial-sized town. But a freak accident happened during a lightning storm, and an Emerson brother and a nephew, I believe, were killed. And the town's folks just didn't want to continue on anymore, so they packed up, and the town was no more. And I can remember as a youngster going out and walking the acreage where that town used to be, and it used to amaze me. How could there be a town here? And now it's this deep wooded area way in northern Wisconsin. And then also my grandmother was the last postmaster of a a lost town in Iron County called Powell, Wisconsin. And she basically was there the last day the post office was in operation, shut off the lights, and the town is totally gone.
What is it like for you when you find a, when you go to a lost town, you visit it for the first time, and seeing what's left? What's that feeling of exploration like?
You can almost feel it a little bit, but it's just an awe. You know, people settled this town, and it was their hopes and dreams, and it's their stories. You know, my Aunt Charlotte once said that land is land, but it's the people who are the history makers. And I try to imagine the people's lives there. They went to church, they went to school, they went to work, and all of a sudden, for some reason or another, that dream died, and they picked up and moved on. And what's left are just the physical remains, and hopefully with viewers' help and stuff, we can put those stories together.
And that's a big part of what you do. You're not just cataloging, there was a town here, there was a town here, through the book. And it's a big book. You cover a lot of ground here. You share what you can find of stories of these communities.
True. Some towns leave a pretty substantial history, depending upon how well documented they are, and some leave little more than the dates that the post office operated. And some of the towns I only cover very briefly because that's all I could find. But I know there's more out there. I know I just hit the tip of the iceberg on these towns. I found about 200. There's got to be at least double, triple that we don't know the stories of yet.
And it's interesting. You share different classifications for ghost towns. There can be a wide range. Can you talk about the range of evidence of remains left behind?
One thing I discovered when I was starting to research ghost towns as a whole, and most of them are out west, but they range in classes or in descriptions. You can start out with a Class A town, and it's based on what's left today. So a Class A town is barren land. You would never know there was anything ever there, maybe a wide spot in the road or something. And then it goes up to a Class B, which there's some rubble left. And then a Class C town has abandoned buildings, and it's nothing of a town yet. And then you kind of get into a Class D, which is a semi or a near ghost town. It's still viable. There's still people there and residents and stuff, but it's not anything near what it was in its heyday. And you go all the way up to a restored historical community. And then eventually some towns are even absorbed by bigger towns.
Talking to Rhonda Fox, author of the book Wisconsin's Lost Towns. She's sharing stories of these communities that once were and are gone for one reason or another. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been to one of these? Do you have one near where you live? We'll go to your calls now. Eugene is with us in Viola. Eugene, hi there.
Hello there. I can name a few of them here in the area. And she may already be aware of, and the ones I'm thinking of are Kickapoo Center, Manning, Adilly, Ash Ridge, Brush Hollow, White City.
You've been cataloging these, Eugene.
Pardon?
You've been finding these, it sounds like.
No, I've lived in this area a long time. I know where these places are at. Now, most of those crossroads are small towns. They were generally had just a cheese factory, a school, and a general store. And within your general store, you'd have your post office, and a lot of times you'd have a telephone exchange. Yeah, a switchboard.
Eugene, thanks a lot for sharing that story. Rhonda, I didn't track all of those down in your book, but I see Kickapoo Center is one of the stories in your book. And Eugene mentioned a lot of times it's crossroads and maybe one factory, one source of an economy. That's a pretty common theme for these lost towns, right?
It is. And, you know, basically when I set out to do it, I kind of set the criteria that it at one time it had a post office, not all of them, but most of them had a post office. And when the post office left, that pretty much the town lost its identity. And rural free delivery was a big transformer there. Once that came into being, a lot of post offices and a lot of communities died. And we're still losing post offices to this day. Just a side note, in about 1900, America had about 80,000 post offices. Today we have just over 31,000. So that's a lot of lost towns, a lot of lost communities.
Well, I want to hear a story or two about communities. You mentioned Powell, your grandmother, the last postmaster there in Iron County, I think it was. Can you tell us a little more about that lost town?
Yeah, it had a school and a church and a little general store, just like your viewer mentioned. And my grandmother was a post office, and when rural free delivery really took effect and the post office started to decline, and in May of 1942, she was the last day of official operation for the post office. So she had an official stamp. She stamped it and said this was the last day of the postal operation here. And it's kind of funny. I found on eBay, I actually found an envelope that she had signed, Hattie Holbrook, back in 1942, the last day she closed the post office. So basically, she turned out the lights and the town kind of drifted away. The school is now a private home. And the railroad tracks were eventually picked up. And it's, you know, pretty much just in people's memories now.
I want to bring on another caller now. Mike is with us in Neshkoro. Mike, hi.
Good afternoon. I have a question for your guest about the, she had said initially that what got her into this was by the Emerson Lumber Company or something. Is that correct?
That's correct.
I was told by the old gentleman who owned it, that I bought it from, that it was run by, it was called Emerson Hill, and it was run by a family called, or an operation called Emerson Lumber Company in about the 1880s. And there was the town that was there was called Cottonwood, and it was also known as Driscoll Spur. It would be about where the railroad bridge, railroad viaduct on Highway 8 is. I wondered if you ever heard of that, and I wonder if there was any connection between that Emerson and the one that you know of.
Mike, thanks for the call. We lost his connection there a little bit, Rhonda, but he was saying he had some land around near Prentice.
Right, and it's actually in about 20 miles from Park Falls. It's on a small county road. It's privately owned now. I have not heard of the Emerson Lumber Company, but the people that our family history, and I have I was able to locate a history written by one of the sons of the Emersons, and I only knew it as Emerson. And it was a substantial size. It was a logging town. It had been formed in about the late 1800s, and a tornado had gone through the area previously, and a lot of downed timber was there. And thus the Emersons came in and took that downed timber and started the sawmill at Emerson. But I had not heard of Cottonwood or any of those, so...
We're talking to Rhonda Fox, regional historian and author of the book, Wisconsin's Lost Towns.
And we want to hear from you. Do you know about a Wisconsin ghost town? Do you drive by some abandoned sites on one of your commutes? Have you visited a ghost town? And what was left, if anything? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. And we'd love to see pictures if you have any.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're talking with Rhonda Fox, regional historian and author of the book, Wisconsin's Lost Towns, about ghost towns all over the state.
And we want to hear from you. Is there an abandoned town near where you live? Did you grow up near one? Maybe you passed by some on trips to a summer cabin or a camping spot. What does it feel like to visit one and know that there used to be a maybe thriving community there? Tweet us at Central Time and let us know. Back to your calls now. Lucy is with us in Black Creek. Lucy, hi.
Hi there.
Do you have a ghost town for us, Lucy?
Well, I don't know that it's necessarily ghost town, but because there's really nothing there. It's called Sweetheart City. It's up in Marinette County, it's north of Privet. And you see it on a map. Like if you look at a map of Marinette County. I just was wondering if the guests knew anything about that.
Lucy, thanks for the call. I don't see it in the index, but is that common? You might see something on a map and there's nothing there?
It is common. Sometimes, even if you listen to severe weather reports, you'll hear little towns that are actually ghost towns that used to be there, but they're still marked as a geographical place on the map, especially if you get a little older map and stuff. I had not heard of Sweetheart City, but it sounds like an interesting story how that got its name.
Thanks, Lucy. I wonder what that story is. Rhonda, do you get people, as you come out with these books or talk about this, you keep hearing more and more from people about these other ones that you can add to your list?
Oh, absolutely. When I first came out with the first Minnesota book, I thought that was going to be it. And then I would travel the state a little bit more, and people would email me and stuff. And it's fascinating. I came out with enough for another two or three books, and I'm sure the same is in Wisconsin. I'm sure I'm missing a ton of them. And, you know, it's extremely hard. I work with the historical societies, which, by the way, are a gem. If you have any stories or photos of places, give them to the Historical Society. They're the keepers of our history. But I talk to libraries and stuff, and I would love, you know, it's the people that tell the stories, because otherwise they are lost to time.
Thanks for the call. Go next to Ryan in La Crosse. Ryan, hello.
Hi. It's an interesting one. Our last name, Geister, meaning ghost. There is a town developed by, I believe, my great-great-great-grandfather called Geisterville. And we don't have a clue where it is. We have an idea that it's in central north Wisconsin. He did own a lumber company in Chicagoland area and went up there to get wood. and created this town, and we have pamphlets from this village, but it doesn't exist.
And you're hoping to track it down. Rhonda, do you have any advice on Geisterville? I don't think is in your index. You have a town name. You know roughly where it is. How would you go about trying to find out where it was?
The first thing that I did is it's called a FORTE postal history, and they have a listing of every post office in every state that ever was. And that's where I go first. I go there and I'll type it in. I'll go to Wisconsin or Minnesota and I'll type it in. And then it at least gives you the county name and when the dates of when the post office existed. And from that, then you can start digging more into county records and stuff. But that's where I always go first, is to find out if it had a post office and how long it operated and exactly what county I'm looking in.
And what would you search for online to find that?
It's called FORTE Postal History. There's a gentleman in Las Vegas who just is a postal addict.
Okay.
He knows everything. But he's very thorough. So if you can go there, you can look in any state and type in your name or look by county and see what towns are around you. It's pretty fascinating. So
that's cool. Ryan, good luck hunting for the family ghost town. I'll go next to Greg with us in Madison. Greg, hi.
Yeah, hi. I was wondering if your guest had any ideas for lost towns that I could possibly visit in the county of Dane.
Lost towns in Dane County. I'm flipping through. There weren't a ton, I don't think, on the list. That's where Pokerville is, though, right?
Yep. Dover and Pokerville. And sometimes there's also a website that will sometimes give you a and that's hit and miss if you can find that, a geographic location for a historical post office. But basically, I tried to find locations and put it in my book and stuff, general descriptions of where you could find it, but they are kind of hit and miss. There's some I know that are there, and you'd never know it. Hmm. But I know then there's others that you can find across the state, you know, that have some remains left, and you can dig around and look around and stuff. One thing I also say in the book is please be ethical. Whatever you take in, take out, and don't take anything out that you didn't take in. So,
and careful if it's private property, too, right?
Right, correct.
All right, we'll go next to Vivian in Green Bay. Vivian, hello.
Hello. A comment and an observation. Observation, Connellsville in Ozaukee County. I was born in 1945, and at one point I remember walking a couple miles to get to the big city, which was Port Washington. Connellsville just sort of got swallowed up, but at one point it did have the school. It had a small general store. It had a mink ranch. And I don't even know when it disappeared, but it just sort of faded right off away. And then a question. Is there any connection between the loss of some of these small towns and our transportation highways?
Vivian, thanks. Rhonda, you do write that some communities disappear when a highway is built over them.
Right, and absolutely. If you kind of think back in history, our first communities were built along the river. And then as railroads came into being, towns were located about every 8 miles on the railroad, because that's how far a farmer could get to and back in a day with their products and their produce. So first of all, it was the rivers, the railroads, and then the highways. And I still see that happening today. I happen to live by a town, small town, and people work in bigger towns and they go shopping there, and so you have no need of your local stores. And a lot of those are dying out when the highway switches. So transportation plays a major role in some of the towns, this loss.
Vivian, thanks a lot for the call. Rhonda, as we start to wrap up, as you said, you know, there's just the tip of the iceberg there. Do you see a sequel to Wisconsin's Lost Towns in the future?
I would love to, because every town I find, I'm like, and I wrote down the names of the ones your viewers gave me, and now I'm going to be off on a search. One of the things is to go to the library, find any local history books. There may be mention of them. Especially local histories that are, you know, not self-published or something. Local historical societies will have them. But, no, I absolutely love lost towns. And, you know, every time I find one, it's like finding a jewel.
Fantastic. Rhonda, happy hunting, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Rhonda Fox is a regional historian living in Minnesota. She's the author of a series of books called Minnesota's Lost Towns and a Wisconsin edition called Wisconsin's Lost Towns.
Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Steve Gotcher with a piece about a special Mexican holiday celebration.
Posadas are an important part of Mexican Christmas tradition. These community celebrations take place on each of the 9 nights leading up to Christmas. The word posada means inn or shelter in Spanish. And in this tradition, Mary and Joseph's journey to Bethlehem and their search for a place to stay is reenacted. Angeli Soria grew up in Mexico, but now calls Milwaukee home. During a storytelling event hosted by Milwaukee's Ex Fabula, she described posadas in Mexico as a community event. But things changed when she came to the Midwest. In this edited version of her story, you'll hear Soria, as well as Megan McGee, Ex Fabula's executive director, translating.
It was when I came to the U.S. I came here in summer. On like the 10th of December, I didn't see anybody moving around on our block. And so I said to my mom, nothing's going on here. These people are really like boring. Yeah, why is everyone so calm? Why isn't there something going on? So on the 16th, when I figured, you know, there should be a posada going on, I went out to the street and I yelled, "This is a lie! There's nobody out of here!"
Salgan!
Come on out!
Y yo gritando y tocando en algunas puertas.
And I was screaming and like knocking on doors.
Y alguien llamó a la policía.
Somebody called the police. I was just there standing, like nobody's coming out.
Me dijeron, me preguntaron, ¿qué haces tú aquí? Alguien dice que tú estás haciendo escándalo.
And they asked me, like, what are you doing here? Someone says that you're causing trouble.
Y yo le dije, bueno, sí, yo estaba preguntando a vos. Alta, ¿por qué nadie salía si era el día de las posadas?
Well, and I was just asking very loudly why no one was out here doing posadas.
Y me dijo, oh, ¿tú eres mexicana?
And they said, oh, you're Mexican?
Dije, sí, yeah. Pero también hay otros que no son mexicanos.
And I said, yes, but there's other people that aren't Mexican.
Dice, that's okay. Aquí es diferente, es guay.
That's okay. Here it's different. It's very quiet during posadas.
Ve a una iglesia.
And he said, go to a church.
Allí vas a encontrar posada.
There you're going to find the posadas.
Y aún estando yo aquí, anhelo tener ese tiempo que yo tuve allá.
And even though I'm here, you know, I remember what I had there. I remember those posadas.
Porque es mi cultura.
It's my culture.
Es algo con lo que crecí.
It's something I grew up with.
Y que al llegar a este país, lo rompí.
And when I came to this country, that tradition broke.
Y la razón es que se rompe es porque se acaba tu tradición. Y no es que tú lo inicies, es porque te estás adaptando a una nueva cultura.
And the reason that these traditions break, it's not that you like deliberately break it, but it's that you're adapting to another culture.
Y invitas amigos.
Maybe you invite friends.
Y conocen
over.
Tu cultura, tu tradición.
And they get to know your traditions, your culture.
Y algunas personas les gusta.
And some people love it.
La prueba está que ahora, no importando la raza, quebran piñatas.
You know, now, no matter what ethnicity or racial background you have, people are breaking piñatas.
En los cumpleaños.
Yeah.
Cumpleaños.
Yes.
Sí. Thank you for listening to me.
Mil gracias, eh?
Thanks to our friends at Ex Fabula, Milwaukee's very own storytelling and community building program, for sharing this story with us. You can hear the full story online at wisconsinlife.org. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Steve Gotcher.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll learn about the musical legacy of Wisconsin composer Fred Alley.
We'll learn about a project that brings healthcare screenings into a hub of the African American community, the barbershop.
And we'll find out how the chili pepper has become part of cultures and cuisines all over the world.
All that and more tomorrow on Central Time.